I'll be 80 next on Sunday. So,
So Shirley, what's your full name and your date of birth?
Shirley Ann Austin, 13th of the 9th, 29.
And your former name, or is...
Shirley McNeil
And where were you born, Shirley?
in Balmain.
And did you grow up in Balmain?
Yes, I did. I was married from Balmain.
And what was your husband's name?
Donald Roy Austin.
And he was a local Balmain boy, was he?
No, he came from Melbourne and we met on Heron Island. So we both worked there for a year and we were together from then on.
What were you working? What work were you
Yeah,
doing there?
I was in charge of the bar and he was in charge of the boats. So, and we both lived there, of course, on Heron.
And how many children do you have, and what are their...
Two. I have Mark Donald Austin, who's 50, and Donna Marie Austin is 49. And Mark's a barrister, and Donna is an administrator for the health union.
It's a
So
big...
they've both been to university. And
And was that something you always wanted them to do, or...
yes, my husband died when Mark was in his first year at uni, and Donna hadn't started. But we always wanted them to make sure they finished their education. So they did.
Can we talk about your journey before you arrived at Green Valley? How long was it after you were married? And what were the circumstances around you arriving?
Well, we were living back at Balma at Annandale, and the two children, there was just the 1 year between them, and they were both attending Birchgrove preschool. I think they were 2 and 3, and homes were very hard to get then. And it came up that we could buy a house at Green Valley on £100 deposit through the Department of Housing, a 3-bedroom house. And, so we put our name down, of course, and eventually, and £100 then, it's nothing now, but then it was. And so we paid the £100 deposit and we went up and had a look, and it seemed to be out of the world. It was so far away from Balmain, but we settled in very well. But the only thing was, of course, there were very few facilities up there when we moved in.
What year was that that you moved?
That would have been what's this? This
2009.
is 09, so it would have been. Donna's 49 and she was about 3, so it was about 46 years ago, would it? So what's that? That'd take it down to the 60s, wouldn't it? The early 60s. So it may have been about 61.
Did you have a car?
No car, no telephones.
So how did you get out there that day to look at the land and the house?
We and I don't think there were buses that day at that stage. I don't know if we got a cab from Liverpool, perhaps. I can't really remember. All I remember was the big hill because we were the corner of Celebration and Sadlier Road, I think. Celebration Road, anyhow. And we were right on the corner, so it was a hill from the very bottom up. So I remember that, and it seemed such a long way out from Sydney. Like Balmain was Balmain, and we'd lived there for years and years, and there were no facilities at all. There wasn't even a phone box. for quite a while, let alone having a private phone. And I don't think any of us had private phones for years. So we didn't have many facilities at all. And the shopping centre was halfway between Liverpool and Sadler. So it was a fair way when you didn't have a car.
They actually call those shops something, didn't they? They call them the halfway shops.
Yes, the halfway shops. That's right. And I can picture them now that we're talking about them. And the doctor's residence was also there. It was there. And it was a strange place when we moved in.
How was that, just some of the realities of the transition from a solid community base to isolation even, and a new base?
Yeah, and I had a huge family in Balmain.
What was it like for you?
Oh, it was really strange. The day seemed very long because my husband left for work early, and as I said, we didn't have a car, and he worked at Mascot. So that meant a very early start in the morning, and he'd work back, say, three nights a week probably. So it was a late finish and an early start. And there was plenty of fresh air. The places were very nice. They were quite big places. We weren't used to as big a place even. But it was the isolation, really, at first was very difficult, because I'd lived in a place that I'd known all my life, that everyone knew us, and I think I had six or seven aunties and all, and I had 25 cousins that lived in the area with me. So, you know, all of a sudden we were isolated. And no phone. Not that we'd ever had a phone in Balmain, by the way. But we could knock on someone's door.
What was your husband doing at Mascot for a job?
He was a printer. He was a very avid reader. He should have been writing the books rather than printing them, if you know what I mean. But he didn't have the chance that the kids had. That's why it was always so terribly important to us that they have a good education. And when we tried to get... The children were both going to preschool in Balmain. They were going to Birchgrove Preschool. And it was a wonderful start for them. And when we arrived in Sadler, I went down to see about getting them in, or getting Mark into kindergarten. And they had from A to J. That's how many kindergartens were at that school. So what would that be? About 11. And I spoke to the headmaster, and he seemed to be, yes, quite... And then something came up and he said, would your children go to the Catholic school if there was one here? And I said, yes, you know, which was true. And he said, oh, well, I think you'd be better off to wait. So he sort of became very closed off then and wasn't prepared to take any more children. But they did have... all that number, nearly everyone who moved there had very small children. And so the infant school was huge.
Was that again, Sadler?
This was Sadler. Mm.
That's phenomenal. It must have been one of the only schools at the time.
Yes, well, and it wasn't far from us. It was just a street down. But 11 kindergartens, you can imagine. Nearly everyone had babies, you know, so...
What was the impression of your first, you know, the landscape? Like, what did it look like?
Well, it was pretty dead. I mean, look out now, all I can see are trees. But there, it was very dead because a lot of it had been bulldozed and the soil had been taken off. So everything was that clay, you know, the red clay that you get. And it was like that. And we're on top of the hill. And so we were built up that high. And it was all this red clay. Eventually I had some work done on it and some soil put in and stuff, not long before we left, actually.
But so, St. Therese, what? So, tell me about...
Well, I'm not sure if the hall was built or not when we arrived, because that's where we used to have Mass. And they were talking about a school. And I suppose we... Oh, that's right. They had housey, as they called it then, going on a Saturday night. And this was supposedly toward the school. But then Reuben F. Scarf came into the picture. And I think it was the Golden Something Opportunity Art Union that your mum and I worked on. And... So I remember Father Muldoon saying to me, yes, but we're still not going to have enough money. And I said, well, what about if we get a house game on a Wednesday afternoon? And that will bring in $100 a week, which is $5,000 a year. That, you know, that was money then. And he said, oh, yes, but you have to pay the the prizes. And I said, yes, but we'll have ordinary prizes, not money. So righto, he said, yeah, but you women will have to get down and buy all the prizes and things. Like, you know, they put a terrific amount on us. I must say, there was so much expected of the women. And you sort of, it was all right for the ones who went to work, but those of us who stayed home at that stage were expected to still pay our school fees and things, but be putting money into all these other things that we had. But anyhow, we did it. And there was a group, you know, there was Barbara, there was your mum, and there was Margaret Carr, there were a few. There were 8 or 10 that were the background, the backbone of the whole thing. But some days we spent day after day there. I mean, it was nothing for us to give you some idea of how the women then. Barbara Carr was always the president of the thing.
Barbara Kane.
Barbara Kane, yes, always the president. And anyhow, and then one year I was president for some reason. And I think the children were being, after the First Communion?
Confirmed.
Yes, confirmed. And the bishop was up. And as you know, Father Muldoon's house was next door to the hall as it was then. And he said, now arrange supper. He said, but stay in the kitchen. Don't come out while the bishop's there. You know, we took a terrible lot off. And anyhow, he said, stay in the kitchen and I'll call out when I want you to boil the water. There was me. And I wouldn't do that for my husband. Anyhow, so I did, and I remember the bishop calling out. This was after the children had been confirmed in the night, and it was getting on, you know. I mean, and so the bishop was sitting there, and he called out, and he said, "Oh, something, did you make these apple tarts or something?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Could you come in here? I'd like to talk to you about the parish." You know, I couldn't say to him, well, Father Muldoon told me I had to stay in the kitchen. So anyhow, I came out and we sat there and we talked for a long time. And I don't know if he was staying the night or what. I can't remember now. And Father Muldoon said to me, it would have been, oh, I don't know, it must have been getting close to midnight. And he said to me, is Sandy coming down for you? And I said, no, he's got to get up at 4 o'clock to go to work. And he said, oh, I don't like driving the women home. See, we weren't treated as you'd expect to be treated now. And I said, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to drive me home. So I remember as clearly as anything him going inside and taking his collar off. And he said to me, you'll have to sit in the back. And he dragged me home. Okay, that was all right. But those sort of things stick in your mind, you know. And we worked all the time. Some of us used to work longer than if we did a 40-hour shift. Like your mum, the whole group of us. And it was always expected of us. But then, as I told you, Reuben F. Scarfe came into the business, and a friend of his, a woman, she did a lot of work too. I can't even remember her name now, but she did a lot of organising and getting things going. And we had all these tickets, and we had stacks of names we had to send them out to. We did all of this, and when that was, I always remember when that was drawn, I think, must have been, he took us all to the Hotel Australia, the committee. I think your mum and dad were there. I'm not sure, but I think they would have been. And I know Margaret and John...
Cairns.
But
Monley, Margaret and Paul Monley.
No, not Margaret and Paul. They may have been there, but I think they were later coming than us.
Kath and John Cairns? No.
No. He was a radiographer, a husband. John... I can't quite remember. And there was, and certainly Bert and Florrie, they were on the committee. I think there were 10 of us, anyhow, that went to the Hotel Australia with him. And I always remember Bert and Florrie, because Florrie was saying we had a pianist playing for us, and he laid everything on for us. And I remember Florrie saying, he was saying, what Irish songs would you like? And she said, The Road to Gundagai. I love it. And anyhow, so we stayed. Reuben Scarfe left after a while, but he just said, you know, you go ahead and have anything you want and everything's fixed up. So we laid it on, I'll tell you something, and we had quite a night. I think there were 10 of us.
Can I ask about, just take you back to that preparation for the confirmation, and maybe talk about what was produced for that, and who, like, you know, you say you made a tart, but I'm sure you probably made 13 of them or something.
There were always, Father Muldoon took it for granted that he only had to say anything and it turned up, you know. And the women had to do this and do that. And we only had the church hall then. There was no church there. And I'm not sure which came first, the school or the church. Do you?
I don't know. I think it was the school.
It did. I think that the nuns wouldn't come up until the church was on its way, or the arrangement had been made for the school, or what exactly it was. And of course, their place was built also. And I remember it was the sort of the tip, but I don't know if that was where the school was built or the church or the...
Yeah, the school was built on a tip.
Oh, well, that's right, because I can actually see that as I'm saying it. And I remember when the Sacred Heart nuns came up to have a look, and they were sort of a bit shocked because they'd come from Rose Bay, of course, and most of them had gone into the convent immediately they left school. And in those days, I don't know what it's like now, but in those days they paid to go into the Sacred Heart. They had to take a certain amount of money with them. So they all came from, you know, fairly affluent places. So it was a bit of a shock, Green Valley. And when they saw all these tiny children, I mean, there were just hundreds of tots. But we built the school, of course, year by year. Donna was in the highest class, which Gregory was, but Mark missed out by 1 year, so he didn't get there. But he had to go to Mount Pritchard, which was very hard to get him into at that time. But, you know, anyhow, they were talking about the school, about when the nuns came up, that they would start with one class, but they weren't used to, I don't know if you want to hear this, but they weren't used to those sort of children. These children came from different homes altogether to what those nuns were used to. For a start, Sister McMahon once asked me what a word meant.
Tell me the word.
Pardon?
What was the word?
Well, it was, I explained it to her that it meant intercourse. So you can imagine what the word was, can't you? And it was a young boy whose father was in jail. And I remember this child. I can't think of his name, but I remember him because Sister McMahon showed me some of his drawings. And at the time, Mark was going to a psychiatrist in Macquarie Street because my Mark was dyslexic, which he still is, but, you know. Anyhow, so she said, do you think you could show these to him? I said, oh, he's easy to talk to, yeah. So she showed, and it was their place. I had the most beautiful garden. His mum looked after it. But his dad was a real criminal, you know, a lifetime criminal. And he was in jail at this time. And when the boy drew the house, you know how they ask a kid to draw their house. He drew it with all black shades and there were no flowers. Everything was dark, you know. So I took it to Dr. Kerridge and I showed them to him. And he said, this child's father's in jail, isn't he? And I said, yes, how did you know? He said, you'd be surprised how many times I've seen these drawings of children whose their whole life has become dark because things are hidden from them, they don't know what's going on, and it doesn't matter what their house is like, they always draw them these ways. And I remember those sort of things, you know, But Sister McMahon, that was the boy that she asked me. She said, what does this word mean? And I said, I wouldn't use it in the class if I were you. And I mean, I wasn't the sort of person to ask. She should have asked someone different to me. But anyhow, that was that. But we had a very sociable time. But they thought that they didn't realise that we also had our families at home. You know, like, you know, there was a Christmas there that you can imagine. We couldn't put Housie off, and Christmas Eve must have been on the Friday night. And so they still had Housie. And the hall had to be ready for Mass the next morning. There was no church. So the men had to clean the hall out. And, or the day before, anyhow, the night or the day before, whatever. And I said, well, rather than me come down and help with the cleaning, anyone who wants it can come up and have something to eat and go back. And we served 94 meals that day. Like, my husband was nearly in a fit in the finish. He said to me, you don't do these things. But all the families came, like, and it was a buffet. They came in and ate when they couldn't, went back and scrubbed the place out so we could have mass. You couldn't have it both ways. But Father Muldoon always expected, expected things to just turn up. And so then, of course, we started to build the school room by room. As you know, it started with one class and went up from there. I don't know what it finished up. It finished up with six class, I think, yes. But the nuns used to get quite a shock at some of the things that the kids came out with, because they were very protected, those nuns.
Your contribution was quite significant. Like, how?
But the group of us.
Yes, that's right. Yes. That's right. But Barbara Kane said, talked to me about this image of you carrying cakes or maybe.
Yeah, well, it was nothing for me to do up to 20 dozen cakes or something. And I mean, you put the ingredients in as well, you know. I mean, we weren't millionaires, any of us. We wouldn't have been up there if we were well off. And we still had to pay our school fees. They never sort of said, oh, you ladies at work all the time, you know, and the others are at work. But your mum will tell you, we were putting in all the time. I remember getting a bill once for £8. I was so furious because I don't know why it wasn't paid, but something had come up. And I think that week we'd spent something like 6 days working in a row. And then I get this bill for school fees for £8. I'm almost sure it was £8. I thought they have no idea about money or anything. They were always used to having. And, you know, people think that it's the men that do all this. It isn't. It's the women that do all the work. Certainly the men did the cleaning and things, but your mum and a group of us did all of that work for the art union. And a lot of other things. We were still, I mean, that's what built the school. But you never really heard much about it. But there are a lot of things that we had going, and there was always, we were always raising money. And we were always putting our own in. That was another thing. You sort of didn't enter anyone's head that those of us that didn't work were still paying money.
But on another level, that, like, I remember Mum cooking the ice bobo, whatever they were, coconut ice, for days, you know, and we sort of packed them in the Tupperware, and there were seven of us, and, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But the other side of that is there's a generosity underlying that.
Oh, yes.
And there's an unselfishness.
Oh, yes, and as well as that, we wanted that school.
So let's talk about that a bit, about because there is that, that's what.
And there was a wonderful feeling between us. Like, you didn't have to be asked twice to do anything. And if anyone who was sick or anything like that, there were always people to give a hand. The generosity was terrific, I must say. It was because we were all in the same boat, I suppose. Like, when we moved up there, we knew no one at all. And I'm sure a lot of other people were in the same position. But a lot of the men were in the St. Vincent de Paul, which made a difference. That meant that their wives and sort of were a part of the group too, because the men kept together. And of course, they were always given jobs to do. Father Muldoon expected, you know, if he asked for something, it was done, and it was. That was the whole point. No one sort of knocked him back. And he was always, you know, he idolised the children. He really did. He always found a way of being in the playground at playtime, as it was then, or at lunchtime. And there'd always be a group of little kids around. Now you'd be terrified to leave them with it, wouldn't you? I mean, honest to God, with what's happened recently. And there was that. There was the camaraderie that built up. But there was also, you'd say, oh, I have to go. I've got to get down to the church at such and such a time. I have to do this or I have to do that. Sometimes I thought it would have been better to work, you know. But there was that. And we had a wonderful... between the women, there would always be some bit of bitchiness if there were a group of women, but there was very, very little. We were tails up and going ahead and doing whatever you had to do. And we really wanted that school and the church, of course. And I forget what the church cost. I know now, but I just can't remember exactly what it cost. I know Father Muldoon told me, and he said in a few years it would have cost an extra £5,000 or something. I think it was just over the £1,000. Might have been £1,250 or something. And, I mean, what would it be worth now? Millions, I mean, a couple of millions. But when the school got off the ground, and oh, it was just wonderful, you know. But he had all the workers, and he was very good. We loved him. We loved Father Muldoon. And, I mean, and he and Sister McMahon were like this. There's no two ways about it. And the nuns in those days, oh, they were so standoffish, and all of a sudden they changed. They'd never been involved with anything like that school. You want to ask me some questions, love?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you're doing kind of... Yeah. I just want to get back to just the description of, like, if what kind of effort everyone... like the volume of cakes that would be made for some of these fundraising events. Like even the school canteen, for example. I mean, were you involved in the school canteen?
Well, I can't actually remember now. I don't know that we... Did we have a canteen?
Oh, we did have something kind of outdoors and a table and you'd be able to buy a drink or something. Yeah, I can't
sort of remember because a while later my husband broke his elbow at work, and in those days... workers' compensation was very, very low, and I immediately went after a job in Liverpool. There was a bread shop opening, and I went to see if I could get a job, and I came out manageress of the shop, because when you've worked a long time, it wasn't hard to get a job in those days, and so I started working then, and because Sandy was off for quite a while, and we couldn't keep going. And as well as that, my mother had Alzheimer's, and I brought her to live with us. Well, she was with us for 10 years, and that's extremely hard when there's someone in the house with Alzheimer's, especially when you have little children. And she thought Donna was me. And so Donna had a very hard time, you know, a really hard time with her. But she died when she was 69, and she'd been with us for 10 years then. But that's when things sort of come back to you. The women said to me, "Don't worry, when you go to the funeral, you just go. You don't worry about anything, and when you come back, everything will be ready for your family." And when I came back, there were the trestle tables from the church or from the hall, and all of the food laid out for all of these people. And my family from Pymble in particular couldn't believe it. They'd been in the parish at Pymble for a long time. And they said, "This would never happen over there, you know." They said, "We just don't mix like that." They couldn't believe what the parish was like, because we did the same for anyone else, and they did it for me. And those sort of things made up for a lot of other things, because we had this community that you don't get anymore. You don't even hear of. And so everything was done, the trestle tables, everything was brought up, and then the men came and took them all back. And my family was saying, "I've never seen anything like this." I said, "Oh, we do these things." And that's what we used to do, not just for me, but for... So there was that feeling that made up for a lot of loneliness in a way, because when we moved up there, you can imagine, can't you, going from Balmain, where I had all these aunts and uncles and cousins, and all of a sudden, and I remember the first time my husband's relatives came, and the one uncle in particular said, "Oh my God, it's like being in the back of Burke," you know. And it was...
So with that meeting, look at that kind of attitude, which was quite full on.
Oh yes. And remember we don't remember, of course, but you've probably heard of it, the big write-up in the paper.
Double page spread. I've researched a lot of media.
My husband got into so much trouble at work over that, because one of his apprentices came in with a toy gun. You know, said, "Oh, I believe you come from..." What did they call it?
Dodge City.
Yes. And, he must have found it hard to keep his hands off the kid, because he got so furious. It had been in the paper. He knew it had upset me and all of this business. And they were supposed to have gone out and interviewed all these people about it. And yet there wasn't one person in our parish interviewed. The priest certainly wasn't interviewed, and the minister wasn't, because we inquired about these things. So who they interviewed, goodness only knows. But you would have thought that there was a murder every night, and there was nothing like that.
How did that impact your children?
Oh, it was awful. It was awful, although they were still only young. They didn't feel it. It was more the parents than... And, of course, they heard the parents talking about it. And it was a big thing. It was... Oh, they said that there was this survey of so many hundreds done, and it was all rubbish. So all of those things came out. And now, occasionally, you still see something about Busby or something about Sadler, but it's now other suburbs have taken over.
So just with that perception of outsiders and how...
Yeah.
It impacted me later.
Oh.
It does impact you. It impacts your children.
Oh.
So...
It was a horrible thing.
It's confusing, isn't it?
Yes.
Because the experience is not that.
No. And we never heard a thing. We didn't. I knew one, the people opposite, was a lovely young woman. That suit that Mark's got on when he had his photograph taken, I used to lend to the people in the street if they were having their kids, their boys' photographs taken. And I remember her coming over and saying to me, could I borrow a suit of Mark's? I said, yeah. He had the long pants one and that one. And I said, yes, love. And her son was Mark also. And I said, what's wrong with you? And she was in tears. She said, oh, my husband's demanded that I get a photograph and send it to him of the children. He's in jail. And I said, oh, well, never mind. And she said, but I don't know how I'm going to pay for it. And I thought, oh, dear God, you know, like, and there were all this going on. People didn't have money.
There was, yes, of course, this huge welfare system. What was your experience like with
The people in our street, the top end of the street, they were buying. Like our place was being bought. Down the bottom, they were renting. I think most of the people in the parish were renting. I don't know, but I just have that idea. And I don't think everyone was offered the places at that deposit in those days. I don't know, but I have that feeling. And people didn't own places then like they do now. You know, I mean, kids own places these days, but they didn't own places. And I think that was, well, it certainly was the first place we ever had a deposit on. We never really owned it. And so everyone was in the same position. They were all broke. And some had been waiting so long for a place that they would have taken anything. Well, we would have.
Can you describe your street, like the people in it? Like,
yes,
some of the names and...
Well, I can't remember a lot of the... I'll tell you who was in our street. Pauline. Do you remember Pauline? She was a member of the parish. She was... I can't remember their surname. She lived at the... She lived at the bottom of the hill and we lived at the top. And she used to always say, oh, it's all right for you people up the top. I'm like, you know what I mean? It was, there was that little bit of...
Yes, because there was a perception, even because we went to the Catholic school, there was a perception that somehow we were better off. Maybe it's because we weren't on welfare. You know what I mean? I don't know.
And it was, and as well as that, the people who were buying their houses, that... And they seemed to be like there were blocks that the people were buying.
Like my parents bought their house.
Yes, yeah, well...
But they had nothing.
No, well, I mean, £100 deposit it was. I imagine for your mum the same as it was for us. Mm-hmm. And we found it hard to get £100 together, but we got it. And but Pauline was at the bottom. And there was a girl who worked for me when I was in the bread shop. She was one of the assistants. She was a lovely woman. She lived opposite Pauline. I can't remember her name either. But she went home one Friday night and died in her sleep. And she was about 38, 39, something like that. Well... That was enough. And the doctor, when I went down and I spoke to her family and that, of course, and they said, oh, the doctor said that she'd been under a lot of pressure having to move here. And people thought you moved there because there was nowhere else, which I, in a way that was right, but we moved into new houses. And, I mean, we never saw a new house where I lived. I had one friend who built a house, and that was, they were the only ones. So we've all walked into really nice places, as far as I'm concerned, though. But there was that, you know, renters and buyers and the children at the Catholic school, and then Mark went to Mount Pritchard, of course, eventually to the Catholic school there, which is very hard to get them into, and I wasn't happy with it at all.
But you weren't happy with the school?
No. Well, for a start, Margot, I remember him coming home with a credit and reading, and I knew that he couldn't read a word at all. He couldn't spell his own name. He couldn't read or write. There was no way. He was brilliant. He had this marvellous mind and memory. That's why he's such a good barrister. He's got this, he doesn't have to read notes or anything. He can address the jury for 3 days and not use a note because he's got it here. But they didn't pick any of this up. Dyslexia wasn't heard of for a start. And but anyhow, I wasn't happy with that. Of course, the schools were very overcrowded, and the Catholic schools in particular. But because the state schools, they just built extra rooms. Well, we were never in the position to build extra rooms, but I still sent him there because I wanted him to go to a Catholic school. I don't think I'm happy now that they went to Catholic schools. They certainly would never send their children. But, you know, that's their way.
Who were some of their friends growing up? Like, what kids came around to your house?
Well, very few. My children, then Donna transferred to, she went on to Liverpool. And we left, as I told you, my mum died, and we left shortly after that. And
what year was that, Shirley? Roughly.
Well, she was 69 when she died, and she was born in 03. So whatever year that would be. So we left then. And we went round.
So you were only in the valley for a few years?
Well, it would have been 10 years, I suppose. I think Donna was 3 and Mark was 4 when we went there. And they were both certainly in high school. Like, we put them onto correspondence courses. And they were in high school when we left. And we were away for a year.
10 years, yeah.
And then we moved to Ashford. We were living with my aunt. She had a hotel in the city, and we were living with her for a little while. And then we got the children to school at Ashfield, so we had to live in the area. So we moved to Ashfield, and Donna went to De La Salle to Bethlehem, and Mark went to De La Salle. And so they finished their schooling there. They did right through to there, except Mark did his HSC 3 times. So he finished up at Tech because he didn't finish, you see. He couldn't finish in time. Even when he had an amanuensis, by the time he told the boy what to write and the boy wrote it, well, he couldn't finish anything. So that was extremely hard for us, as you can imagine, because Mark was going to Paddington for special reading lessons to Sister Mary Leonore for ages. From when we lived at Sadler, I used to take him down four days a week after work to have these lessons, and we paid for all of those, of course. And so it, you know, it took a lot. He reads and writes now, but he still doesn't spell, you know, correctly. He has some words. Nothing for him to ring interstate and say to me, "Mum, how do you spell such and such?" You know, he gets mixed up with the who's and the what's and the things that are sound different to what they spell. But he does it right.
What were some of the significant, like, just thinking about Green Valley, who were some of your closest, who were the people closest Will, it meant the most to you in that time.
Well, Bert and Flight, we kept to ourselves a lot, I must admit. As I said, my husband left early for work and got home late. And I worked a lot of the time then in the later part. And Florrie would call in on her way home in the evening and we might have a glass of wine on her way back from work. Of course, she always worked also. But even when we worked, we still did things for the school and the church. But so we more or less kept to ourselves a lot. You know, we went...
Your pride.
We didn't have many... we didn't have much spare time. You know, by the time you get home from work and then you do the kids' clothes for the next day and you... And then, of course, I had my mum also, which made things very difficult. And so when we left, we went back a couple of times for... We went to Father Muldoon's funeral, someone else's funeral, if I remember correctly. But the people there were very, very good. You know, they were wonderful people. And that's why it was so hard when that story, because the people that we knew were so, they were so good. They did so much for other people. Nearly all the men were in the St. Vincent de Paul, and I'm sure. Well, in fact, I've heard them say some of the places they went to, they were better off than what the men were that were going round and giving out the things, you know. But it was a strange, strange place. But it was a very good place to get a. To get a home together, and it had its goods and its not so goods. But people didn't get off their backs. That was the whole thing. The reporters, and that was disgraceful what they did.
Yeah, not much level of research.
No. Well, we didn't know anyone who was even questioned. And why wouldn't you go to the parish priest for a start? And the ministers, well, none of those had been questioned. So it was just a beat up.
What about the shopping centre when it opened? Were you there?
Oh, yes.
So there was kind of a meeting place there.
Well, it sort of, when it opened, it was good. But then it became a thing that the young ones in the night took over. And these were the ones that got into the trouble. And I worked then at the TAB, which was just in the shopping centre. And you had to be quite, I'll say this, you had to be quite careful. Because the young ones then were starting to more or less take over a lot. And they weren't the people who moved in the first place that wanted a home. They wanted to bring their children up in the best way they could. But all of a sudden we were getting, and look, I've got nothing against unmarried mothers, but it's not that. It was the ones that came up that there were no fathers to... you know, to influence them when they were growing up or to tell them right from wrong or whatever. And so it had started to become not a very good place to go at night. In fact, my husband used to come down and pick me up after I worked. Because from that time on, I always worked. And then even when we came back to Sydney, I went and I did a course and I became a diet supervisor at PA. And that was the last time I saw Paul Monley. He was down and he said, oh, fancy, you know, for some reason or other. And he said, what are you doing? And I told him, he said, oh, I wouldn't mind doing that course. I said, you'd have a bit of trouble getting in. But, you know, although they took men, it wasn't that. But they only took 13 a year from the state, so.
And what was the nature of that work?
Well, I supervised everything that went on in the kitchen and with the diets. So I lived in for the 4 months, the main 4 months. My husband looked after the kids and he still worked, but because I thought it would be better to live in and pick the brains of the young ones, if you know what I mean. And anyhow, so that's what I did. So at each hospital we worked, I stayed at the hospital. So I got a qualification. So even after my husband died, I had that position.
How long did you do that work for?
Until, yeah, I think I was about 58, something like that. I worked at most hospitals, but when my husband got ill, I was offered a job in Queensland at a hospital that was just opening on the Gold Coast. And I said, I'll consider it. I said, but it depends on my husband. And I went home and I said to him, I'd been offered this. And he said, well, if you're going to be sick, it's a lot better to be sick on the Gold Coast than what is here. So we moved, and you couldn't believe it. That night, Donna came over. When we decided, and Donna came over and she said, my application's been approved to change positions. Where do you think I got? And I said, I imagine Albury, because that's what she was saying. Please don't send me to Albury, because she worked in the courts then. And she said, no, the Gold Coast, Mum, Tweed Heads. And can you believe this? This was the week we were moving. She knew nothing about it at all. And we'd only just decided. And I said, Donna, I'm going on Tuesday. She said, where to? And she said, Mum, I'll go with you. And so we went up, and Sandy stayed at Bondi at our unit there with Mark until I settled in. And then he came up, and Mark got a couple of the boys to stay with him, and because he was still at uni here. And so we didn't know he was in, and Mark was, and Sandy was only in hospital overnight to have some fluid tablets, to have the fluid taken from his legs, and he died overnight. So he's only 46. So everything blew up, we just. It just went completely. So Mark said, oh, Mum, I'll get a deferment. And no, you won't. So anyhow, he stayed on, and then they finished things. But your life turns around. All of a sudden, everything changes. So then eventually I got this place.
So you came back from the Gold Coast?
Yes, oh yes. Previously I rang Westmead. I knew the dietitian in charge there, and I said to her about it, and she said, Shirley, we're only allowed to employ people who are previously employed in the hospitals that are closing. She said, but as soon as you get down, ring me. And so I rang her, and eventually, of course, and then about 8, no, I was travelling from Bondi to Westmead and starting 5:45 of the morning, by bus and a bus and train. And then I got the offer of, I was told that there was a diet supervisor's position at PA. Well, that's where I originally worked. And but it had closed. I rang the dietitian in charge, and he said, Shirley, I'm sorry, but it's closed. He said, I suppose I could reopen it. So anyhow, he said, come down and see me. So I knew I had the position as soon as he said that. So anyhow, I got a PA then, which made a bit of difference, 3 hours a day. So, but it was very difficult after Sandy died. So we sold the place at Bondi. We hadn't had it very long. Oh, I wish I had have held on to it, of course. It was only a block and a half from the beach, a 3-bedroom unit with a lock-up garage. How much do you think?
Well, probably close to 2 million.
64,000 it was sold
for. These days,
for.
I meant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it was a block and a half. Of course, Mark was in the...
More than that.
Yeah. And a huge three bedrooms. I mean, how often do you see a three-bedroom unit these days even? But the garage was even on a different title to the unit. But anyhow, it got the kids through uni, and that was more important than anything else.
It's very generous. We all study in our 30s, the girls.
Well, yeah, but, you know, circumstances alter cases, love, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yes, and, you know, I mean, had my husband not died, we probably would have still been at Bondi, but you don't
know what's ahead.
No, you don't know what's changing.
So how's life?
Now, is there anything you want to ask me?
Well, you've covered quite a bit.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to keep going off the subject.
Yeah, no, you were all right. That was good. Is there anything you want to add at all?
I'm just trying to think, because you know, it's been long time.
I think you gave a nice overview.
And of course, I've had a few strokes since then. It's the brain doesn't work the same way.
No, that's right.
But even what you've mentioned, of course, has brought things back.
Mm. What about Liverpool Council? Do you have any perception of them back then?
No, not really. I can't. I think the men did anything that had to be done as far as councils or anything.
Yeah.
And Father Muldoon had a lot of pull. I must say, he had a lot of. He sort of managed to get things done. And, of course, everyone did anything the nuns wanted. It didn't matter what happened. They did anything the nuns wanted, which I could understand, you know. But they were so... I have to say this to you. They were so shocked at our children, really. You know, they got to the stage that they were sort of expecting the children to... Well, they thought they were the kids from Rose Bay, and ours weren't brought up like the kids from Rose Bay. We did our best, and our children were well behaved, but they didn't bow and scrape, like you know. And Donna came home and one day and said to me something, and I said, "What did you say?" And it was something in Latin or something. Well, the kids weren't up to this. No, in French. That's right, in French. Or something or other. I said, what's this? And she said, "Oh, sister, said that we greet each other." Can you imagine the kids at Sadler greeting each other in French of a morning? Like those nuns were so way out, because I tell you, they nearly all entered immediately they left school or whatever. They all entered at about 18. They knew nothing about life at all.
Well, they were in for a big shock.
Oh, of course. So fancy coming from Rose Bay to Sadler, to Green Valley, that there was nothing there when they first came up. There was a rubbish tip. That's what it was. But, of course, they wouldn't move until the place was ready for them, which you can understand. And, there were all the time of the people, their friends who came to the fates and things. You wouldn't ask your mother about some of those. I don't know if she remembers, but they'd come up, you know. They were used to the fates at Rose Bay. I mean, we had our tables laid out with a load of cakes and anything that was second-hand. And they got out of these big cars. It was a funny time in a lot of ways. Talk about the rich meeting the... I mean, all of those nuns came from rich families. I mean, they had to pay to go in, let alone. And they paid for all of their own stuff. But, oh, dear, dear, dear. I remember Sister McMahon getting in touch with... who was the racing trainer? His daughter's the trainer now.
Tommy Smith.
Yes. And he told her, I think, I don't know if she told me, she went out with his brother at one stage. She must have been very young. But anyhow, with the brother, that's right, and he's a trainer also. He works for Gay now, I think. And she was telling me, she rang and they told her to back this horse. I think it won, if I remember correctly.
Because they used to play the horses on Saturdays. The nuns would have a little kitty and they'd all...
Yes, there was something...
Sorry, I just want to get some shots as you're talking because you're quite expressive and it's a nice light coming just in on your face.
I'm awful with photographs.
You're best to just relax while I'm...
yeah. My granddaughter and great-grandson were over during the week, the great-granddaughter. And I said, what are you doing? She said... I'm just letting him get used to taking a photograph, but he knows he can only take one. And I said, what's on the phone? She said, yes. She said he wants to fool around with it, so if I let him take one photograph, it's a lot better than not letting him take any.
Yes.
And so there he is, the three-year-old, taking my photograph with the phone, you know, and she was showing it to him. She said, now here's the photograph, but you can see that you've taken it a bit too low down. And she was instructing him to take the photograph. I said, I can't even do that.
How many grandchildren do you have?
I've got two granddaughters.
And who are they to?
Well, they're Donnas, but they're sort of step as people do these days, and Sarah is married to Bart, which he's the most wonderful, wonderful boy, and he comes over and does my odds. He comes in with a load of light globes and he replaces each one that I have. And he also does my curtains. It keeps breaking off. As you can see, it broke off again. So he does that for me. And anything else that I need doing, he does. And Mark does anything electrical, but he, as you can see, he's pushed this out so that I'd get a better picture on the TV, because that's the antenna up there. That's a little antenna. And he brought me a new TV last week, because as I said, it's my birthday. And he's put a thing on for me this week in a restaurant in town.
That's nice.
And, oh, yeah, oh, is it?
I don't know.
Is it? Anyhow,
yeah, something nice,
there's a lot of people coming and it's a private room and all that business. And anyhow, he brought me down a new TV and he put it in the bedroom. He said, Mum, I wanted to get you a big one, a big one. I said, that's big enough for me, Mark. And he said, yeah, but I was going to put that one in the bedroom and you could have the big one, the new type, up there. And I said, no, just get me one for the bedroom. So anyhow, he put one in the bedroom and then he started fooling around with this because... You know those new things coming in, the digital, whatever. Well, I'm not getting the picture I used to get. So anyhow, so he said, if I move this out, that'll be better. Move the furniture out. And after he left, I thought he was going to put that back. But anyhow, I thought, oh, well, when Bart comes, he'll shift it back for me, you know. He's Mark does murder trials all the time now, and he's always he's under pressure all the time. It's too much. They're terrible. You know, it used to be different when he did little bits and pieces, but now no, now he's just done another horror, and
yeah, it must take its toll.
Oh, he did that one. You know, the plastic wrap. Did you hear that? The woman supposedly wrapped her father in plastic wrap. Well, he did that. He got her off. And he's just finished that horror one with the baby, the child suitcase. Being...
Which one?
The child, the seven-year-old being in the cot and starved to death. Oh, dear God. He went through hell doing that. I'll tell you something. And that hasn't been, it was supposed to, they were supposed to go for sentencing this month, but Mark was in Armidale doing another murder. And so it's next month they get sentenced. But he said that was dreadful. He said, and the reporters made it worse. He said they were dreadful, Mum. Because the first trial Mark ever did was that Jeanette Baldwin, Janine Baldwin. Remember that girl that was... And he was only very young when he did that. He wasn't the main person doing it. And when he came out the court, there were people spitting on him. And from now, he always leaves the court by the back door. He doesn't make statements. Well, he made a statement recently, and it said, he said, I agree the jury came to the correct decision. That was his statement. And the opposition had this great big photograph and all that. He said, oh, no, I don't do any of that, Mum. He said, I don't. He said, I learnt my lesson, you know. But it is very pressure. But he arrives, he brings a TV, but then he pulls my furniture out. As long as I get a good picture, it doesn't matter, you know. Oh, they both live in town, both the kids.
Will I stop it here?
Well, love, any questions to ask me? Is there anything I can, you know? Well, if you think of anything, ring me.
Yeah, I will.
And they were part of the parish. They were all part of the parish. And the first little girl...
there was the Purcells, Christine.
Yes, that's right, Christine.
There was the Jarretts.
Yes, and there was another one. There were three in a short time. And Christine, they were on a family picnic, and there was a lot. And, of course, everyone thought she was with someone else. You know how it happens when you separate your children. And anyhow, and I remember... At the Christmas, you know, the nuns went to a big thing at Christmas, the Christmas pageant or whatever, that, you know, the enactment, reenactment and all of this with these tiny little children. I mean, they're only in infants. The eldest was about seven, so these were like this. And... I remember Sister McMahon saying, where's the other angel? And one of the little boys turned around and said, that was Christine and she's dead. And that was how it was. She was sort of part, but she was a very quiet little girl, really quiet. Quite a standoffish sort of child, you know what I mean, who didn't mix. And I think that's how she drowned. I think she's... but anyhow, yeah, they're ready to go on. And Sister Muldoon said, Sister McMahon said, where's the other angel? And this kid, it was Christine, she's dead. And you know how kids accept things so easily. And she said, oh, yes, that's right.
Pause this and I'll pause my...
It was increasing, do you understand it? I said, oh, yes, I do. Have a lovely day.
Do you remember the school performances? Did you have much to do with those?
Not really, but yeah, they, oh, that's right. The last year, I think, of infants, oh, they put on one of the Gilbert and Sullivans, if I remember correctly. I mean, you don't have seven-year-olds doing Gilbert and Sullivan, do you? Have you ever heard of it before?
It was, no, it was either, we did two, by the way.
Yeah.
It was either HMAS Pinafore or the Mikado.
I think it might have been Pinafore. I'm not sure, but it, I remember this. I thought, my God, only the Sacred Heart nuns would get to this. Gilbert and Sullivan, it's, they were six or seven, the kids.
So, do you remember, I ran into a woman the other day that used to deliver the groceries, but it might have been. Anyway, she knew all about my father's shoe size. Leaving the boots out. Do you want to talk a little bit about your childhood?
Yeah, right.
So, you mentioned, what are some of your earliest kind of, are you memories of growing up in Balmain?
In Balmain. Well, for a start, as I told you, I had a lot of cousins. And our family was very well known. Although my name was McNeil, I was always one of the Sullivans. You know, that was my mother's family. And we had a police sergeant there. His name was Bunny Shepherd, but we weren't allowed to call him Bunny. It was the adults that, for some reason or other, he grew up as Bunny Shepherd, and he was the sergeant of police. And we used to be allowed to go to the movies as we're older on a Friday night, but they came out at 20 to 11, and we had to be in the house by 11 o'clock. There was no stopping to have a milkshake or anything like that. And if we were a bit slow walking down the street, he'd be behind us. And he'd say, you Sullivans, your mum will be out the front. You just hurry on, please. You could imagine doing that to kids these days, couldn't you? They'd tell him what to do. But he'd be outside the movies each night. He'd say, you Ainsworths, go that way. And so, and he gave us all the instructions. We wouldn't go against him for anything in the world. And he'd be right. My mother would be standing at the gate waiting for us. And I'd say that we were in our teens then. So, I mean, earlier, sometimes we went to the movies on a Saturday afternoon, which were the pictures then. But we didn't have much outside entertainment. But we did have a lot of entertainment in the family. My families were great. Well, my mother in particular was had a marvellous voice, wonderful voice. And I believe that her mother, when she sang at Mass, everyone else stopped to listen. And my mum, even the ones that, she had a couple of relatives who were on the stage, and everyone said, oh yes, but they'd never sing like your mum. Like, if we had we had parties in those days. We had family parties. And the neighbours would say, well, you ask your mum to open the windows so that we can hear the singing, because that's what people did then. They didn't, you know, they had their glass of beer, but they didn't roll around the street or...
Didn't have iPods.
No, they didn't have anything else, you know. We had a pianola, not at our place. My aunt lived two doors up, and she had a pianola. And so it was always family outing. The women would each, one Friday night, say my Auntie Iris would have the sisters there, and they'd play cards or whatever. And the next Friday would be someone else's turn, and the others would bring supper, and, you know, it was a big thing. And I remember them, when I was only a kid, sending me up to the fish shop on a Wednesday to get two lobsters for their lunch. That's how cheap lobsters were in Balmain in those days, because we didn't have money. You know, I mean, there wasn't a lot of money around. But, and see, I was born in 29. Well, the Depression was just on the outer then, but it was still around as I was growing up. And my dad had been out of work for 5 years. And that's a long time. And once he got a position, and he was a Scotsman, my father, and he was a boilermaker. And when he got a position in the railway, eventually, and he never left that job. He was there until he died, until he retired, because he wouldn't have, you know. He didn't want to ever be out of work again. That was the whole point. So it was like that. And, of course, in Balmain in those days, there were, I'm not sure of how many, but well in the teens of, like, there might have been 15 or 18 hotels. There were hotels on every corner. And the hotels closed at 6 o'clock, of course. And so everyone had to be out by 20 past six. So there were sly grog places. So we grew up with all of that, but we also grew up with a real family atmosphere, and everyone knew everyone else. And this side of the street, they were all Catholics. The other side of the street, they were Protestants, except for one family. And they never argued about religion, but it was a real big thing in families in those days. Oh, it was big. My father's family, they were so Presbyterian. And the Saturday before I made my first communion, my mother was taking us, my sister and I, to dancing lessons, you know, which was the thing then. And my grandfather was standing on the corner, and he called out, and he said, "Mary, is that right? The band's making a first communion on Sunday." And she said, "Yes, Pa." And he said, "She doesn't come into my home again." And that was it, until he was dying, which was when I was about 16, I think. No, that's how strict in those days. That religion was the big argument in families. It was not just in families, but in streets and all, in a lot of places.
It's interesting. So that was that British-Irish thing?
Yes, because my family were Irish and my father's family were Scotch. And that was, oh, it was the regular thing. There were big religious arguments. And when I went to school, I went to the Balmain Primary. And as you probably know, the Catholic school and church are straight opposite the public school. And Father Morris, it was then, that was the priest. And he used to stand outside with his big walking stick and make sure that no Protestant children crossed that road, and he'd chase them off. Oh, he was a horror. And when I made my first communion, going to the state school, I made my first communion, and he had every one of us in tears. He told us we'd all go to hell. And there was to be no celebration because it was, you know, there was a big celebration if it was the Catholic school. There was to be no celebration because we're all on our way to hell and our parents were going with us. Oh, it was dreadful then. Religion was a terrible thing. But my mother still insisted that we went to Mass. But, he used to give us a terrible time, the children who went to public schools.
It's sort of quite terrifying.
Oh, it was dreadful. It was terrified. And the children who weren't even Catholics that were coming out of the state school, he refused to let them cross the road to... Yeah, they had to bring the police down one day. They eventually sent him back to Ireland. But,
to the sanitarium.
Religion was such a terrible thing. But we used to make up for it. We'd go down to the Salvation Army on a Sunday evening because they served supper. So all the kids went down there, you know.
It shows you kind of...
Balmain was a strange place then. But everyone knew each other and you never heard of any... We never took a key out of the door. It was always left. In fact, when we eventually brought Mum up to our place, we had to have the lock broken because the key had rusted in the lock. It had been in it for so long. Because no one, you didn't hear of a house being broken into or anything. I mean, you wouldn't do it now, would you?
Is that how you learned to cook with your family?
Yes, yeah. I when my mother worked as an office cleaner. They used to have split shifts in those days. She went in from 6 to 9 in the morning, and then she went back in the afternoon from 5 to 8. And but you never let anyone know that your mother worked. You know,
there was a stigma.
Yes, yes.
Women should have been at home.
They should have been at home. So I was, from the time I was 11, I did the cooking and my daughter did the housework. When I say that, we didn't do the whole thing, but anything that needed to be done, we knew to do it. And that's what we did. You didn't sort of say, oh, no, I'm not. You didn't say to your mother, no, I'm not going to do it. It's a bit different now. But, so Balmain, but it was a wonderful place to grow up. I had the pool, you know, the Dawn Fraser pool now, a penny to go in, and if you didn't have it, we knew he'd let us in. You know, And we knew that one could pay the penny and twist the thing and the other one small enough to get in. And the man who had the canteen, he knew that what we did, so. And we'd be down there every day of the school holidays. You'd be at the pool. And we used to watch Dawn Fraser's brother. He was a diver. And her family had tuberculosis. And in those days, you knew, you know. And he died from tuberculosis. But he was the most wonderful diver you've ever seen. And, of course, she started swimming there, but she was a lot younger than me. It was a terrific place to grow up. We used to get a rowboat and go out on the thing and we'd tie the big rope to the back of one of the ferries and they'd pull us along and all of that business. We'd put a sail up, a blanket as a sail. And you never got into you never heard of anyone getting into trouble.
So you grew up on the water, really?
Yes, yeah.
And fishing?
Yeah, we all went fishing. And you'd go and get squid first for your bait, and then you'd... And a lot of the men would go out overnight in a rowboat. Yeah, no one had motorboats or anything. It was a good place to grow up.
And working class, of course.
Very working class.
What did you eat?
We ate well, but everything was cooked at home, of course. There was, I remember when the first takeaway opened in Balmain. It was a Chinese place at the back of the theatre. There were three theatres in Balmain then. There was the Hoyts, the King's and the Amusio. Well, there's none now. And there was this place opened, and you had to take your own containers because there were none of these takeaways. And so there'd be this lineup of pots or pans or whatever, and you'd have a sticker on it, what it was to be. You know, you're going to have this or that and that. Pardon me. And Friday night was a big night because the men got paid. And so you'd leave your pots or whatever there, and they'd say, come back in 20 minutes or whatever. And there'd be this whole lineup. It'd always be a Friday night, and the wives would not cook that night. They'd either go to the fish shop, because Friday was Catholic night, and you always had your fish on a Friday night. And the others would go to the takeaway.
That was the and there were Chinese people ran that?
Well, there were Chinese. I can remember one Chinese person, but they're mainly Australian, but it was called the Chinese restaurant. But there'd be a whole lineup of people.
And you go to the movies?
Oh, yes, yes. That Saturday afternoon in particular. And you'd get a cartoon, a serial. This is before interval and a movie, and then there'd be interval, and then there'd be another movie and the gazettes, those that were suitable for children, because the war was on and they didn't show all the gazettes. But I remember a Friday night we went, and I would have been a teenager by then, and they had a notice up to say that the news would be shown over after the film or films, and that it wouldn't be suitable for some parents wouldn't want their children to see it. And I still remember it was the people going in and saving Belsen, bringing the survivors of Belsen out. And because the newsreels came out on a Friday, and we had newsreel theatres then. In town there were three in the city, and they kept going the whole time. You could go in at any time and leave at any time. So that was the only way we had of getting the news, because there were no TVs, and you had to wait for your newspapers. So that was how things were then at that time. But it wasn't a bad way of growing up. And you certainly didn't hear of the crime that you do now. There was once a stabbing in Balmain, and I remember people saying, oh, that would be one of the Lascans, as they called them, the men who worked on the ships, the dark men. Yeah, that would be one of the Lascans. It wouldn't be an Australian who would do that, Stas. And I remember when the men came back from the war and they went looking for the deserters. You know, oh yes, they had lists of the deserters. Their wives would write to them and say so-and-so, or their mothers would write and say so-and-so deserted. And they'd come looking for them, because a lot of the men were really badly wounded, and we used to sit and watch, waiting for the fight to start. You just took it for granted that there'd be a fight.
When they came back and in their homes.
Yeah, and it, especially
with their wives.
With the wife, if they'd played up. If the husband, the mothers of the husbands would keep an eye on the wives. And God help them. And the deserters, they'd bash them in the street. They were leaving the towns. And it was a strange time. So it was a very interesting time to grow up. Australia changed terrifically, but not always for the best. Anyhow, I've kept you a long time, darling, haven't I?
It's all right.
Are you working?
Yes, this is my work.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's good.
Well, I do what I like. So
oh, well.
I had to get you. That's all. It's all right. Don't worry. Do you want to say a little bit more?
Well, I don't know what else if you want to ask me.
Tell
anything.
Me about
but
how
I'll tell you what, I think I better go to the ladies if
right.
you don't mind.
Okay, we're going again now.
Right.
So I have to remind you about the bishop, but we're
going
yes, to
well, I,
talk about the romance of you.
I've sort of started that I wanted to get away, you know. I mean, I'd lived in Balmain all my life, and I'd been in Fiji for about 18 months. I went over, there was the lady who lived next door to us. One of her daughters married a chap who had a business over there, and she asked me would I like to go over and get a job there, like they'd give me a job there. And I was very naive at that stage. And I went over on the Erangi, the last trip of the Erangi. And my aunt insisted that I had to go first class. So I did. And had a single cabin. And I was coming out of the shower one day. You didn't have... there were no showers in the cabins. It was at the end of the thing. And there was a lady there, and she said to me, "You're a child of Mary." I had my medal on. And I said, "Yeah." She said, "So is my daughter." She said, "So you'll join us to..." And I said, "Oh, yes, yes." So I travelled with them. From then on, I was at their table, and I met, and there was another lady there, an Australian woman who was married to an American officer. He was a doctor in the services, and she was at that time you couldn't take all of your money out of the country, so she was spending on trips and things, the money that she had to get rid of. It must have been a hard life. And anyhow, so we became very friendly, and these people were wonderful to me. And we were held up in New Zealand. There was a strike on. And so they took me to all these places, to the... where they have all the racehorses and things out to graze, and that all of these farms or whatever
studs,
they are, studs, yes. And so we went and visited all these places, and we were there for several days, and it was like a holiday on the holiday. And so anyhow, eventually we got to Fiji, and I left them, and my friend met me because she lived next door to us all of her life. Her mum, as far as I was concerned, was Barty, and so when she invited me over, my mother said, "Yes, but you'd have to get the money, like, to go." But anyhow, we did. And so over I went, and I had a job there ready to go to at W&R Carpenters, where he was the, her husband was the manager. And we lived on Levuka, which was a beautiful island, which in the when the it was a full moon, they didn't put any lights on. I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but the moon shining on the water, and we lived, of course, right on the, as you can imagine, and the road went around, and there was just the road and then the water. And so I got this job, and looking back at it, oh, dearie me, I was a horror to even do it. But I hadn't heard of coloured people, or, you know, I mean, you didn't run into too many in Balmain. So the people working in the office, they were all they were, as they called them, half caste. They were all of them, I think, were the offspring from American servicemen who were in Fiji during the war. And of course, there were no marriages or anything. And so they all knew their jobs. I knew nothing about it whatsoever, although I was good at maths, I must say this. And we didn't have computers and things, so the head was used. And it wasn't until I'd been working a few weeks that I found out that I was getting four times the amount that the Fijian people were getting. And they knew the job, and I didn't. I mean, I did, I learned, but even then it didn't enter my head the difference. It wasn't not like older, and I looked back on it and I thought, what a horrible thing to think that someone comes into your country, takes a job that someone else would have had, and gets paid four times the rate that you get that know the job. My kids would take a fit at that. I mean, oh, dearie me. But anyhow, that's how things were. So I was there for about a year and a half, and then I came back, and I wasn't very happy at home at that stage. And so I decided that I'd go work my way around. Well, the first job I got was looking after some children in the country. Oh, my God, it was a terrible job. It was a dreadful job. And the eldest child was 12, and he had the they all had the measles when I got there. And he used to tell me to carry him out to the thing. You can imagine me, I was a little girl. But anyhow, I didn't last very long. And my aunt sent a car and picked me up and brought me home. And so a little while after, I had the chance to go to Fiji, so I went. So I was over there for about 18 months, came back, still wasn't very happy, and so I just started to get a job around. And I worked in different towns. And then I worked in Warialda, and I saw how the Aboriginals were treated for a start, which really shocked me. And at that time, our Aboriginals weren't allowed to be served in a hotel. So what they used to do, they had a special, behind the bar, they had special boxes of wine that was the cheapest that you could ever see. I think they sold for 18 pence at that time, 1 and 6 that was. They sold them to the Aboriginals over the back fence for 10 shillings. And when I mentioned it, you know, I said, well, there's something wrong. You didn't give the change. Rather naive. And I was told, well, that stops them from drinking too much. And I wasn't that naive. I said, oh, come off it, like, you know, it's not for that. You're making about 7 times what you should have made on it. And they said, oh, yes, but, you know. And so I didn't stay there that very long, a few months or so. And then I got up to Brisbane, and I went to a Catholic hostel where I'd lived in Catholic hostels. And I went, and they didn't have any room. But the nun in charge said to me, even if we had to put a cot on the roof, we'd find you somewhere. And so they did, and I moved in. I was looking for a job, and the Bishop of Brisbane used to come there for his breakfast of a morning because he said Mass there, because at the cathedral it was too hard for him to get up and down the steps and that. And of course, that was when they said the Mass with their back to the parishioners. And they were up and down all the time. So he used to come for breakfast. And one morning, one of the nuns came to me and said, surely Bishop James would like to meet you. So I went along and he asked me where I'd been and what the missions were like over there. And we had a long chat. And And then the next day he sent for me again, and I had a cup of tea with him, and I said to him, I'll never forget, I said, I've applied for a position. And he said, oh, that's very good, you must work. And I said, yes, I applied on Heron Island. And he said, oh, he said, it's an ungodly place. He said, there's no church. And I said, oh, I said, I haven't got the job yet. And he said, well, see what you can do and let me know. So anyhow, I rang the woman or she rang me, I just forget now. And I told her that I'd lived with my aunt in the city and she had a hotel and she taught me the bar. And she said, oh, we're looking for someone to manage the bar. She said, are you interested? I said, oh, yes, yes. So she invited me over to their house, wherever it was, I've forgotten now. And so I had the job. Off I go to Heron Island. But before I left, Bishop James said to me, Neil... And he said, have you got your beads? And I said, yes. And he pinned a medal, I think it was Pius the Tenth, I think he said. It was a friend of his, because the bishop was quite old. He was lovely. He said, I'm putting this on to you. He said, now you're a good girl, you stay that way. You know, he was quite indignant about me going, but anyhow, he said, and when you come back, I want you to come and see me. So, right, I went to Heron Island and take over the bar, and Sandy, as it happened, was working the boats. He looked after the boats and all of the fishing and things. And so he took me home the first night, and that was it. We didn't separate after that. I mean, when my time was up, and we all finished at the end of the season because the cyclones come, and so he was going back to Brisbane, I was on my way to Darwin, and there was a motor accident, and so I finished up in the hospital, and instead of him going back to Melbourne, he stayed in Queensland, and then he came back to Sydney with me, and then went back to Melbourne for a few weeks and came back again, and so we married after that. And I was on my way to meet a chap in Darwin, and I didn't know until we'd been married for several years, and I found out that the letters that didn't come were because Sandy he brought all the mail in. Well, mine he just took away that came from Darwin. I didn't get those. And I thought that John had never written, you see. And also I'd sent him my photograph, and that's how I found out if Sandy had it. I said, where did you get that photograph from? He said, oh, you gave it to me. No, I didn't. Said, I sent that to Darwin. He said, oh, I think that's one of the envelopes that's split open. But anyhow, so we were together after that. But I was still the same when I got married as I was when I was 16. There was no, you know, anyhow. So we had all that time. We never, until he died, we hadn't been separated and all that time. So it's funny how your life changes, isn't it? Because people in Balmain didn't travel in those days like I did. They thought I was strange.
It was quite radical, really.
Oh, yes, yes. And see, there weren't the planes. They were.
So it took a bit of courage, really. You would have had, yeah, had a bit of get up and go to do it.
Oh,
you?
Yes, yeah. I was only 20. I was 21, I think. I don't know if I had my 21st or my 22nd birthday over there. And it was strange because the planes were so expensive. Even to come home, I flew home, but it was, well, it was a heck of a lot more than it is now, comparatively. I just forget how much it was. I think it was something like £155 or something, which all that time ago, you know, you're looking at 60 years ago almost. That was a lot of money. I came home Pan-American. My God, you should have seen what they gave you when you got on the plane, never mind about anything else. I mean, I know they still give you these slippers and things, but these gave you a takeaway, you know, bag that had a complete set of makeup, you know, all the dressing gown, everything you could think of. And the plane itself had a viewing area of glass that you went up the steps and you could just see everything. God, times have changed. And I've kept you a long time, haven't I?